Hey, Junkions, don't freak out. Don't freak out. I know you're wondering who the hell is talking right now. This is Meryl Barr. I am the editor and producer of Junk Food Cinema. I'm stepping in here because just want to let you guys know that this is a really cool episode that Brian and Cariel got to record with Eric from We Hate Movies. But in the process of recording it, there were some technical difficulties. So right around the 51-minute mark, basically, mics go haywire and gremlins take over the system. It's a whole thing. The point is that you're going to hear a very drastic change in the audio quality. And I just wanted to make sure you guys knew that before going into the episode. Other than that, it's awesome. Enjoy it. And on with the show.
Dead or alive, you better saddle up, Junkions, because it's time for another Rough Riding episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com?
Dot, damn it, you've got to stop doing that, especially when we're doing this episode, because then I think something is terribly wrong with the audio. God damn it, Cargill. Hey, by the way, that voice you just heard, this is a very auspicious episode for a number of reasons, not the least of which being it's the return of the Pat Garrett to my Billy the Kid, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, a return. I was gone for a week.
I know, but people thought you were like, I got a lot of concerned messages like, where the hell is Cargill? So
like, just follow my Twitter. I was literally gallivanting around London for a week and a half. You can only, when you're American, you can only gallivant around London.
I think that is the appropriate verb for sure. But and I call you the Pat Garrett to my Billy the Kid because I am convinced that at some point you will end up killing me. So
best $1.10 I ever spent.
If you want to hear more witty repartee like that, you can gallivant over to iTunes or Blog Talk Radio and hear our entire back catalog. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show, if it's the kind of thing that you would saddle up and regulate, if you want to regulate our ability to continue doing this show, you can head over to patreon.com/ Junk Food Cinema. And for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. At the $5 an episode level and above, you actually get access to a complete extra episode called The Deep Dish. We got some exciting things on deck for that. So great time to be a patron, if I do say so myself. And it's a great time to be listening to Junk Food Cinema. I am super, super excited to say that we have a very special guest joining us all the way from New York City, from the podcast.
New York City.
Yeah, this guy podcasts in New York City. Get a rope. Mr. Eric Siska from We Hate Movies, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And yes, New York City has not only the best podcasts, but the best salsa in the business.
You damn lies.
That is a bold thing to say to two guys sitting in Texas right now.
Sitting in Austin, Texas. Like, we are literally in the cradle of Tex-Mex right here.
The cradle.
No, I know. I was just thinking about that old commercial, right? That's what you were referencing.
Yeah, I really.
No,
really
we're
was.
Referencing our habit of shooting people who don't present decent enough salsa at our parties.
True sidebar.
Hold on. We're going to Jürgen pause now.
Yeah. So, for those of you that are a little confused, back in the day, back before the mid-90s, Pace Picante Sauce was actually based out of San Antonio, and the old advertisements for it would start out, you know, this picante sauce was made in New York City, New York City, but they would always say, you know, made in San Antonio by people who know what picante sauce should taste like, which was true, and then they moved to another production. They moved their production to another city to be cheaper, but it wasn't a city that would actually sound good for saying that people knew what picante sauce tasted like. So they literally stripped that out of the commercials. And so there's like this line of demarcation of Gen Xers to millennials as to where good picante sauce is made.
I am so sorry that I forgot to do this before you started talking. Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
I didn't know we had, we're building up a soundboard of this stuff, aren't we?
Oh, the way we're recording so that Eric can join us, this particular program has a live soundboard, and I am super excited about that. And don't worry, it might get used throughout the course of the episode, but bringing us back... that is, of course, we are still in the summer of 88, one junkie
still,
summer.
It's only now June.
Why does it feel like, maybe it's because we've been doing this podcast for so long, but it feels like we've already been doing summer of 88 since February.
Not only that, now I'm getting bitched out because I don't want to do summer of 89.
Oh my God.
We're a year away from 89. And I feel like, you know what? Anybody who has a problem with that, I dare you, go back and watch the movies from summer of 89. They are best. They're best talked about on another podcast, perhaps called We Hate Movies, than they are here on Junk Food Cinema, because most of them ain't good. I love how people are like, but that's the summer of Ghostbusters 2 and Batman. And I'm like, those are the best movies. Literally, that's what we're talking about.
Eric, you guys haven't covered Ghostbusters 2 on We Hate Movies yet, have you?
No, we have, actually.
We have covered Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, I don't think it's that good. I don't know. Go back and listen to our episode on it for the full report. But I prefer the original.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And I do want to warn you, Eric, to use the parlance of your podcast, for the last 5 years, Junk Food Cinema has been a We Love Movies situation. And definitely in this case, as we talk about the 1988 Western heartthrob classic, Young Guns.
Can't go north because Murphy's got men coming out of Fort Sumner. He can't go south because he's got Brady coming in. East is no good because he's got John Kenny coming up now.
Let's dance!
Those are just boys. They want them over 21.
We don't have a lot of fun now.
All I see are hired thieves. Get off my property.
You were supposed to serve 11 warrants and expose the ring. Instead, you went out on a rampage.
Get ready for hell.
Objection, Your Honor.
The governor's revoked your deputization powers. You're now wanted by the legitimate law as well as those outside the law. You're being hunted by troops.
Bonnie is believed to be the captain of a deputized gang.
Billy the Kid, huh?
The governor's put a $200 bounty on your head.
Ain't easy having pals.
So, Eric, tell me about your first experience seeing Young Guns and what your relationship is with it.
Oh, my God. You know, what's funny about this. It was in the summer of 88. I was 5 years old. So to date myself.
Old man Cargill, that old man. God.
But listen.
Are you upset that you're still the oldest person by like a long shot?
By a long shot. Like I was like five. Wow.
And what's funny is I feel old now. Like I feel old with there's all these younger people coming up. But so I saw this trailer. One of my earliest memories was Young Guns, because I remember seeing the trailer back then. And I was like, even then I thought, like, you know, when they're showing that intro shot, they use it in the film and they use it in the trailer of you're zooming in on Emilio and everyone's like got their hats on and it's like very stylized. And I was like, oh man, this ain't your mama's Westerns. even back then I knew it was, this ain't your mama's Westerns.
How many Westerns was your mama watching?
Well, I guess it was more my papa. he was a big John Wayne head at the time.
Oh, of course. As I feel like everyone's dads were John Wayne heads.
Well, but he's hitting it right on the head. I mean, that's the thing about Young Guns is, when Young Guns came out, I was in high school and it was, I was just entering high school. And, it was a cultural phenomenon. Like it was of the films we're talking about this summer. This was the movie that all the teenagers were freaking out about. Like Die Hard was something that guys like me had gone and seen in the theater three times this summer and just would tell our friends, dude, have you seen Die Hard yet? And they're like, no, I don't like that moonlighting guy. Like, It was that movie that would become this iconic classic. Young Guns, people couldn't shut the fuck up about Young Guns. It was the perfect crossing of brat pack culture with the sanitized hard rock acid acid jeans culture of the late 80s.
Yeah.
Like it was there was a reason why they focused on Bon Jovi for the, like, this is the Bon Jovi Western. This was a movie that was cool to people that drove fucking Camaros and chugged six packs down by the canyons.
Sure.
Cause that is the type of movie this was. And this movie felt it. And even though when you watch it, it doesn't translate that way now because it was more of a classic Western in the term, in the way it was structured. It still, at the time, it was something new. It was something fresh. It was getting what I grew up watching with my dad and putting it with all the stuff that my dad hates that I love now, like Emilio Estevez.
Your dad hates Emilio Estevez?
I can't explain it.
Your dad's just angrily watching Mighty Ducks like, I want the Hawks to win!
I have no idea if my dad hates Emilio Estevez, but I kind of like the idea that he does.
I feel like he would hate Charlie Sheen more because it's like, at least keep your own name, you Hollywood fancy pants.
I don't know, man. Charlie Sheen is definitely Martin Sheen's son, and who doesn't love Martin Sheen?
I'm excited that you said that because I didn't know that acid wash jeans came in a boot cut. So it's good for me to know that Venn diagram overlaps.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't know that because I was three when this movie came out, Eric. So you are you're even slightly older than I am, and
wow,
still vastly younger than Old Man Cargill. But now that we're all here and we've kind of broken the seal in this discussion, I feel like we need to start this show off by regulators mount up, because if nothing else, the legacy of this movie is that opening line in the Nate Dogg and Warren G song Regulators about regulating any stealing of his property, and we're damn good too.
By the way, a classic Salisbury staple, if you've ever seen him do karaoke and you haven't seen him do this, then somehow
you didn't stay very long, because I will do it every time.
Once he gets enough beer in it beer in him, he will do every bit of that song.
I love that. Like, it is kind of unhealthy how much I love that song. Like, it's literally the text tone that plays when my wife texts me.
It is.
It's just that do 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 do. Which, by the way, that music is from Karate Kid. So they've taken dialogue from Young Guns and music from Karate Kid and created the hook for Regulators.
Yeah. Remember when in the 90s when rap culture was really about nostalgia for the 70s and 80s? I miss that.
And now for the word in edgewise, here's Eric Siska. I am really sorry that we've kind of been monopolizing this so far.
No, not at all. No, I'm just fascinating hearing all these, things that I might have missed about the past.
Oh, boy. Saddle up, my friend, because I was in the past.
Yeah, it's true. He definitely was.
It was a good time to be alive. The summer of 88. There were good releases.
Yeah,
there were, and that's why we're doing this. Although the thing is that as good as it is, like in terms of movie wise, in terms of music, it was where music had gone to die. From 88 to 92, there was just this wasteland. So, like, literally the best stuff on the radio was Bon Jovi and Def Leppard. And I used the term best loosely. It was like, if you
that term is slippery when loose. That's
like,
all I'm going
to
say.
Maybe you're listening to a little Whitesnake, or maybe you're one of those kids who's not so much into this sanitized hard rock and you're listening to Roxette.
Nobody's listening to Roxette. So, okay, now I want to know I do have the look. I want to know what 5-year-old Eric was listening to in the summer of 88.
You know, it's funny you bring up Def Leppard. I remember my uncle came by one probably around that time, and to impress him, I told him I did like Def Leppard, and it became a running thing in my family that everyone just like, oh, Eric, big Def Leppard fan.
He likes bands with seven arms.
Jesus Christ.
It's like I didn't really even know the music, but I got saddled with it for a few years. But as a 5-year-old, I didn't listen to much in general.
What, you weren't hot up on the top 40 as a toddler? That's incredible.
I was still listening to Falco.
Amadeus, Amadeus.
Okay, thank you, because I was like, Amadeus. Falco versus Taco, which is which? I always get those confused.
Yes,
so.
Falco is Amadeus, Taco is putting
on the Ritz. Got it. Okay, I'm glad you cleared that up, because that has been a lifelong problem for me. So let's get into what this movie is, because Young Guns, hilariously, as much as it is a vehicle for heartthrobs, as much as it was nicknamed Young Buns because it was during this period of time, it's part of a trend that I think we're still in the middle of now, where we have to make all history sexy. Like, if we really want to examine our history, both American history and the history of the global community, we really have to aim for it being as sweaty and hunky as possible.
Well, I mean,
it's horny history.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's absolutely right. Like, if you want to really connect with history, you got to try to fuck it. I mean, that's the human way. If you want to understand something, you have sex with it. And
yeah, I mean, you're thinking about the past. What do these people go through? What are their day ins and days out? We see them shooting a lot, but how are they fucking, and who are they fucking, and how do they look when they're fucking? I'm sorry. Is this a podcast clean audio? I'm sorry if I was
no. Okay. No, we've done at least two episodes about the act of Dutch ruddering. So I think you can go ahead.
Yeah, we are absolutely. I mean, it's a Cargill and Brian podcast. There's no way it was ever going to be clean. So,
by the way, thanks for listening, Mom. I really appreciate it.
So, but this is the era where the Brat Pack was trying to grow up.
Yeah,
and they were still trading in on their whole Brat Pack concept. By sticking together and doing films that could, you know, be looked at as a Brat Pack movie, but it still was, hey, we're adult actors now and we're making serious films. Look, we're making a Western, and Westerns were few and far between in the 80s.
The 80s was not a good time for Westerns.
No, except that the Westerns that came out were really good. That's the thing, is you look at stuff like Silverado, you look at some of the later Clint Eastwood stuff that would happen in the early 80s, and it was all really good. There just weren't many of them.
Right. And I think that's an important thing to talk about, because this movie came out at a time when, like, the biggest Westerns were things like Bronco Billy and Silverado, and most of the Westerns made during this period were being made in Italy and Spain.
Time Rider,
yes. Or like Walter Hill making Extreme Prejudice.
Why did you say it that way? Like, it isn't a movie in which Fred Ward rides a motorcycle back into the Old West. Like, that isn't the greatest concept of a movie ever.
Let it be noted, I never at any time, Your Honor, said that that is not the plot of the movie, because it definitely is the plot of that movie. But it's weird that you have a movie like this that comes out as they thought about, like, we've done Breakfast Club, like, that was a great Brat Pack delivery system, but how do we do that and really examine the Lincoln County War at the same time? And that's what I find so fascinating about Young Guns, is that it is a horrifyingly accurate depiction of the events of the Lincoln County War.
Yeah.
Like, this movie, maybe more so than any other film about, and there are quite a few films about what is essentially a dispute between, a dispute over a beef contract with the government. There have been multiple movies that have told this story, and this one is perhaps the most accurate. Like, we're talking about a feud between two barons, one named John Tunstall, played in this movie by the immortal Terrence Stamp.
Fuck yes.
Who is basically the Fagin of the Regulators. He's just gathering up runaways and orphans and giving them an education. There's a lot in this movie about how you can't go through life just shooting people. You have to learn to read as well. So it's got a very LeVar Burton message to it. Strangely missing from the cast, LeVar Burton, I feel like, would have been a nice addition. But to run down the Regulators, as we've said, we've mentioned Emilio Estevez. We also have Charlie Sheen in this movie. So we have technically two Sheens in this movie, but only one going by his given name.
One making it halfway through the movie.
This is true. We also have Lou Diamond Phillips as Chavez E. Chavez, which I thought was a really racist name until I found out the real guy's name was Chavez E. Chavez. So my apologies for assuming that casting Lou Diamond Phillips as half Mexican, half Native American with two Mexican names with an E in the middle was racist. It's
by the way, in terms of historical context, this is the movie that blew him up. Like, everything that Lou Diamond Phillips would do after this would be because of how much everyone loved him in Young Guns.
Which is funny, because apparently when he went in to read for the part, they kept explaining it to him like, he's this and he's their kind of their mystical guide, and you know, he's really good with knives. And he's just like, okay, great. Okay. And he keeps waiting for them to give him a page to audition. And at the end, they're just like, so what do you think? And he realizes, oh, they're just offering me this part. I'm not actually going to audition at any point. So
I'm auditioning them. It's having been in a meeting like that before. With Lou Diamond Phillips. Yes. No, it is the most surreal thing. And it's one of those things where halfway through you start realizing, oh, wait a second. I was here like tap dancing for a job and they just assume I got the job. The question is do I want it?
Yeah.
And so, and Lou Diamond Phillips was so the right person for this role.
Yeah, absolutely. And then of course we have, speaking of redundancy, we have Dirty Steve Stevens played by Dermot Mulroney. That's right. Sorry. I always get
you don't have to make the joke because
yes, you do.
Because everyone out there is immediately thinking you're talking about the other one.
Yes. It's like the Aaron Eckhart, Thomas Jane problem.
Yes.
Where they've actually been in a movie together, actually two movies together. And I assume that both of those are about cloning. Because if they're going to be on screen at the same time, somebody had to got their atoms split.
No, one of them have. Here's a question for you, Eric. Have you done Molly yet on the show?
The drug?
Okay.
That's two questions there. I have two questions.
We'll answer that question later. No, have you done the Elizabeth Shue movie with Thomas Jane and Aaron Eckhart called Molly?
No, we haven't. I don't think I've even seen that film.
It is something we will never cover here that really you guys need to cover. It is literally a remake of Flowers for Algernon, except with autism, where Elizabeth Shue plays someone who's autistic, but they get everything about autism wrong to such an offensive level that Elizabeth Shue at one point strips naked and walks into a room saying Molly hot, Molly hot.
Oh my God.
It is literally one of the worst movies of the 90s. And the fact that you guys have not covered it, I think, is a war crime.
Look, it makes riding the bus with my sister look like What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
I'm writing this down right now, Mom.
You are not wrong. That is exactly like, were you there that night we showed it?
Oh yeah. I cannot erase that movie from my head, much as I may want to, much as I have hit myself in the head with a hammer several times to try and accomplish exactly that.
But see, the thing that Dermot Mulroney and Dylan McDermott have
are very similar names and looks.
Well, that's the thing that they have over Aaron Eckhart and Thomas Jane is when you hear that name, you can isolate the career. Their names are practically interchangeable.
Yes. Yeah, it's very true. It's like if you're playing Scrabble, like you have to challenge anytime anyone plays either Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott because inevitably they're going to get it wrong. And then we have I haven't mentioned Kiefer Sutherland yet, who plays a character named Doc, who they keep referring to as Doc. So of course I'm thinking Doc Holliday.
No.
That's what I was thinking the entire time until I read on the IMDb trivia that this guy was just also nicknamed Doc because he failed out of medical school.
Yes, Doc Scurlock, who I think went on to make Old West documentaries about how bad McDonald's is. So, that's Doc Spurlock. Sorry, I get those confused.
Yeah, he was also very terrible at finding Osama bin Laden. Remember that movie? Holy shit.
Yeah.
But was there ever a point in the creation of We Hate Movies that you were going to call it, hey, remember that movie? Holy shit.
Yeah, that was the working title.
It was in the mix for sure. And then the most famous, arguably, of the entire group was, of course, Casey Shemeshko.
Who, by the way,
I literally have the pronunciation in front of me.
He's the guy that nobody remembers from Young Guns who actually has a more impressive career than most of the guys in Young Guns.
Well, in so much as he has played a lot of cronies. He is the greatest cronier since Wingshauser or the other Affleck.
You know what? We're gonna say his character name, and you're gonna know which movie it is.
Oh yeah, let's play this game with you. So I'm gonna name a character he played in, I believe, multiple movies, the same character, and you will probably guess franchise. Ready?
I probably won't, but let's try.
He played a character called 3D.
Back to the Future.
There it is. Yeah, but when you actually look at his career and the titles in his career, he torpedoes Dermot Mulroney and
Kiefer Sutherland?
Not Kiefer Sutherland.
Charlie Sheen?
And Lou Diamond Phillips.
Oh, okay.
In terms of just pure franchise power of like, hey, what movies have you been in? Oh, you know, I was in Back to the Future and I was in Young Guns and I was in this little movie called Stand By Me.
Also playing a crony. Like if we did an entire actor's career and we had to come up with a junk food pairing, it'd be a cronut. It'd be a cronut for Casey Shemeshko because he plays cronies literally all the time.
He's in The Phantom, for fuck's sake.
He is in The Phantom, which probably was spurred by the fact that another crony in the Back to the Future movies was Billy Zane.
That is correct.
So that's probably the connection. And we have spent a lot more time talking about Casey Shemeshko than I thought we ever would. So
I actually assumed we would have this conversation because it's like we've already talked about several Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland movies on this podcast over the years.
We have indeed.
I mean, in fact, we've talked about another movie where they star together where we referenced this movie.
Was it Three Musketeers?
Yes, it was.
What did we call that movie? Young Rapiers? And then it was like, that's way too close to something else.
That's a little too rapier.
So it was like Young Blades. And then, I think we went through like a whole workshop process to come up with a better name for that movie. And then, of course, none of this to be confused with the 1990 movie Mobsters, which is Young Tommy Guns with Patrick Dempsey.
Oh,
and the only person missing from this cast, in my opinion, Christian Slater.
Yes, man. Slater. Whew.
How is he not in this movie?
Slater hadn't hit big yet.
Well, he did Heathers. This was the year that Heathers came out.
Yeah, but that was literally the first time people really kind of recognized him. It wasn't until Pump Up the Volume that he became a huge...
Pump Up the Volume was prior to this, wasn't
90.
It? Oh, it was. Oh, I thought we covered it on Summer of 86, so I think I was backwards.
He was too young for Young Guns.
Yes. That was a preteen Guns.
So let's take this Tiger beat for just a second, now that we've talked about all the members of the cast. Who is your favorite of the Young Guns, Eric? Which one ranks the highest on your dream boat meter?
Well, I got a soft spot for Kiefer Sutherland, I think.
Sure. As anyone who watched 24 or the movie Phone Booth, which I'm positive everyone has seen.
Of course. Slightly underrated, honestly. At least I remember it being, but I don't
like
know.
It's like if AT&T produced the movie Liberty Stand Still, Phone Booth. Like, but people listening are like, I know what half of the things you're saying are in that sentence, so I'm just going to go ahead and tune out. I think Kiefer Sutherland's a great pick because, I mean... Lost Boys. He's essentially kind of playing the same role he played in Lost Boys, only...
And who could forget Flatliners, which my brother made me watch ad nauseum, so...
Flatliners is great.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, even something like Dark City. I mean, he's got a good presence, I feel.
Okay, so Jürgen, pause now. The other day, I'm flipping through Amazon Prime to see what movies are available. The Flatliners remake is available there. And if you want to talk about a movie that everybody forgot existed, it was last year, or possibly this year's Flatliners remake.
I did not get to see it yet. How is it?
I haven't seen it. In fact, I didn't see a single trailer for it. Do you remember a poster, a trailer, an ad on the radio for that movie at all? Because I don't.
I do, but I also remember everybody's initial reaction to that movie, which put it on my back burner. And I had just recently rewatched the original on Shudder. So I was like, nope, full up on Flatliners. Don't need any more Flatliners right now.
I'm full up on Flatliners. How that wasn't. The tagline, I will never know.
So who's your favorite of the Young Guns?
I got to go with Emilio. I mean, he's my favorite Sheenstevez, so I think I'm going to have to stick with him. What about you, Cargill?
Oh, I'm Lou Diamond Phillips all the way for multiple reasons. One,
his middle name is Diamond, and that's fucking cool.
Well, I mean, first of all, he has the best backstory of everyone here. He's got some of the better character moments in this movie. He instigates one of the greatest, most realistic drug sequences in a film ever.
Yes.
Because he gives everybody peyote tea and they don't have some deep, meaningful, mystical plot related experience. They literally just sit there tripping balls, shooting at shit, scream out over the hills, acting exactly like you do when you're on fucking peyote, and then wake up and go, shit, that was deep.
My favorite moment of that tripping scene is, did y'all see the size of that chicken? And Dermot Mulroney is just yelling that over and over again to no one.
He saw some giant chicken. But the other thing.
Thank you for clearing up why.
Yeah. Come on, logic.
Peyote logic, folks.
But here's the other thing I've always loved about his character is, you can tell when they were making this movie that his character is pretty much a merging of the real character with James Coburn's character from The Magnificent Seven.
The knife throwing. Yeah, I thought that same thing.
The way they do it is exactly the way they do a bunch of the Coburn stuff. And he plays it very similar to Coburn, to the extent that I think Lou Diamond Phillips sat down and rewatched a couple of Westerns and zeroed in on Coburn.
And then Christian Slater took it from there for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, yeah,
very true. Everybody's just throwing knives out here. And I guarantee
we've not done Prince of Thieves yet. How well, is
we
that
will,
a thing?
We'll do Prince of Thieves. I mean, we've already done one movie with a Bryan Adams ballad. So
we should hit all the Bryan Adams ballads for a while.
Just do a whole month of movies that have ballads by Bryan Adams.
We Hate Movies is going to, I think we're planning on doing Prince of Thieves to coincide with that new Robin Hood movie in November.
Oh, yes, of course. Have you seen the trailer for that new Robin Hood movie?
I have, yeah.
It's a lot like every other Robin Hood movie, except it's a lot like every other Robin Hood movie. Like, I'm still trying to figure out. They keep talking about how it's like a twist on the old story, and I'm watching that trailer like, what's the twist exactly?
Here's the weird thing is that when you look at the history of Robin Hood movies, Prince of Thieves is the last truly good Robin Hood movie, which is saying a lot. Yeah.
It is kind of good. Like, I understand how dumb it is with Kevin Costner in the part, but it is kind of good. And besides that, you've got like, you know, The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, and that's about it. Yeah.
The closest anyone's come to making a good Robin Hood movie since was Disney, which made a movie with Keira Knightley called Princess of Thieves.
What?
Yeah.
I never heard of
this. Oh, yeah. No, it was a made-for-Disney movie.
Put the peyote tea down for a second. Are you sure that's a real film? Or is this just something you dream about when you're alone at night?
I am positive. Okay. It's about Robin Hood and Maid Marian's daughter.
What?
I can't believe you have not seen Princess of Thieves. It's actually not bad.
I love this. I love this concept.
Was it written by the same guy who wrote all the Berenstain Bear books?
No,
or?
Dude. Not only does it exist, IMDb it right now while I go on a rant.
All right.
But not only does it exist,
I'm gonna go to the Tribune, as some of our fellow podcasters
on
say.
The box cover of it. It says Keira Knightley, and then in parentheses, Episode One, Star Wars Episode One, whichever fucking that thing was
called. Oh, the Phantom star, Menace. Like they were promoting that?
Because she had that small role playing the bodyguard in the Phantom Menace.
Oh my God. The body double of Padme.
Yes, because of that, they used that to sell her as a star. Now, looking back in retrospect, it's ludicrous that you would think Keira Knightley and then her big credit is Phantom Menace. But that was exactly how it was sold on the box.
That is horrifying to me that it was like from one of the stars of that movie everyone already hates comes Princess of Thieves. I'm still trying to reach the Tribune for.
I found it, and it looks like it was a television movie that they might have done into like a TV series, I guess, if it was successful. Oh, and Malcolm McDowell plays the sheriff of Nottingham.
You are fucking kidding me.
I'm not. Like I would make something that awesome up.
You would. You literally, this entire show, we do shit like that. So don't act like it's above the scale of reason that you would just entirely make this up to fuck with me. But
this just went to the top of my watch list.
Wow. God, that cover even has like the white border all around it.
Yes.
So you knew it was a Disney family movie from the early 2000s.
Yeah. No, it was one that showed up in my video store, and I popped it on, and it was the first time that I was like, holy shit, this Keira Knightley girl really has some talent. And I would, because it was rated G, I could play it in the store whenever I wanted. I was like, you know, that's a fun little adventure movie.
Tonight on Horny History, we examine the story of the Princess of Thieves. And Chavez y Chavez, his middle name is Diamond. And also next week, we have Albert Einstein and the relative hotness of dat ass. E equals MC Thirst Trap. I want Horny History to be a show. How do we make that happen?
I really don't want a podcast in which you go back and want to fuck Einstein. Like, that is just...
It's
well, you know that poster with his tongue out. I mean, come on.
He knows how to use that tongue. That's all I'm saying.
So somewhere in here, there's this movie called Young Guns.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bringing it back to the story, back to the lecture at hand. So we mentioned Terrence Stamp as the guy who's kind of wrangling all the regulators and giving them an education.
And who the fuck does he butt heads with?
Oh, just a man. A man by the name of Jack Palance.
God, I love Jack Palance so much.
So do I. And the thing is this came out around the same time as City Slickers.
There
was this long headcanon going into the 90s that this was just Jack Palance. You know, that this was
Curly.
That was really Curly.
I'm going to need an antacid. I seem to have a stomachache from all the scenery that I am chewing upon.
Because that's what he's doing once again as Jack Palance chewing scenery. Which is what we all pay to see. This is why we're here.
Yeah, that's what you want.
I'm so excited. Like, and I love the fact that he hates John Tunstall for being English. And throughout this whole movie, he plays a guy named L.G. Murphy, who has a terrible Irish accent, because Jack Palance doesn't have an Irish accent. And he is just like, it's like trying to keep a wolf at bay with a wooden chair. He's like trying to keep his American accent from just swallowing what little Irish he can pull off. And I love it.
Also, there's an interesting character note about this guy is that he had his shirt ruined at a laundromat, you know, and he determined that the daughter of the laundromat would now become his property over the shirt.
Okay, this is the one part of the story I was unable to confirm as far as the real Lincoln County War. So maybe instead of focusing all my that's racist on Chavez y Chavez, the fact that he calls the girl that he has abducted China, her yep. name is just China. To him, and at one point she runs away and he's just screaming. He's standing in the middle of the street. Jack Palance just going, China, China. And it's like, oh my God, I love this movie so much.
Except that's not the only bit. Like, there's actually the moment where Keeper Sutherland is going back and forth with her and refers to her as the China girl, and it's kind of like, yes. You couldn't come up with a better name than that.
Really should have come up with a better name than that. Or, you know, call her Butterfly. That's what he keeps calling her during his peyote trip. He just says, she's my butterfly.
No, it's her. The other way around. He's the butterfly.
No, but then he says flower. It. He's like, I'm her butterfly too. And it's just like, so chickens and butterflies are apparently what people see when they trip on peyote. That's good for me to know.
Have you tripped on peyote?
Not recently. No, not since I got clean. But okay, so the actual plot, I swear we'll get to it. So John Tunstall refuses to back down from bidding on the same government beef contract that L.G. Murphy. Again, this is the plot of Young Guns. It sounds like I'm describing a Ken Burns documentary that nobody watched, but this is the actual plot here.
Well, if you get to the specific underpinnings, I mean, it's just a revenge movie.
Yes.
But it's just a great revenge
movie. It's a really great revenge movie because L.G. Murphy and his goons end up murdering John Tunstall. And Terrence Stamp, by the way, oh my Zod, that guy gets blown to fucking Krypton. Like, they don't just shoot him. They shoot him, he goes up into the air and then to the left. Back and to the left, to bring up Costner again. Literally back and to the left. It is crazy.
Zapruder film, by the way, underrated film.
I love that he almost does like the Charlie Sheen platoon moment right there in slow-mo when he gets gunned down.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, of course, spurs the regulators into revenge. And one of the many moments of, you know, Eric, I'm really glad you mentioned this earlier about seeing the trailer and everybody kind of being introduced. This is more so than any movie I've ever seen in the 80s. This movie is just its own trailer for about 85 minutes. Like, there, and I know that's idiotic to say because every trailer is made from the movie that it's advertising. I mean, you wouldn't like sit down for a trailer for U571 and expect to see scenes from The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. Like, I get that. But this movie will literally grind to a halt.
I really kind of want to see that movie
right
now. The sister sub of the Traveling Pants.
I love it. Get Hollywood on the phone. I know you know people.
With Keira Knightley from episode one, The Phantom Menace.
Episode one, The Princess of Thieves. Yeah, absolutely. But this movie will literally, Young Guns will grind to a halt so that they can pose. Like, and that opening, that whole opening looks like this week on Young Guns. I mean, I have a theory that you could lay the theme song from any 90s sitcom underneath that opening and it would work just as well.
Sometimes the world looks perfect. Nothing to be afraid.
So no one told you life was gonna be this way.
You just said 80s and then you jumped to the 90s.
I said 90s sitcom. You could put any 90s sitcom song under that opening and it definitely works. Like Emilio Estevez pops up, thank you for being a friend.
Well, the thing is you could do that, but then you'd have to call it Pals.
Yeah. Wow. This week's on this week's very special episode of Pals, the guys try to convince Dermot Mulroney to stop smoking or something.
Stop being so racist.
Stop being so racist. Oh, he hates Chavez. He hates him so much.
For no good reason other than he gets in the way of Chew and Chaw.
Yeah, which one's Chaw again? I don't remember.
No, he's the Dermot Mulroney's always got a mouthful of Chaw.
That's right.
I'm a racist.
Little known fact, that was
that's why I didn't recognize him. I thought it was the other guy because he was always chewing.
He was always chewing. And little known fact, that was actually Big League Chew, the whole movie.
Really?
No, I made that up. Sorry for that.
He's not used to your facts. Yet.
Yeah, he's not used to my in-depth research that, by the way, thank you so much to our research team who did all this work for me to just make up shit as we go along.
It's fake news.
There were no regulators. All beef is regulated accordingly. It's great. We have the best beef in the whole world. Regulator steaks is going to sweep the nation.
The Murphy people, they totally had an insider put into a gang.
There was an informant within the Bundy Ranch. This is sort of like a Bundy Ranch situation.
I think it's a Bundy Ranch. I think that honestly, the regulators in Tunstall are like one bad week away from being the Manson family. Definitely. Like it could easily go there. That's all I'm saying. So after Tunstall's murdered, one of the many trailer moments in the movie is when they're all deputized by the local justice of the peace. And they have that scene where they're like, everybody put your hands on the Bible and break. And then they all step back perfectly in line and cock their guns at the same time. Like they're going to take a photograph. There's no photographer.
No.
It's just a trailer moment hidden inside the movie.
It really is. Although we keep stepping over this and we've talked about most of the cast and we've left out one of our favorite alums of all time. Yep. Who convinces the Justice of the Peace to deputize them?
The stepfather himself, Mr. Terry O'Quinn.
Fuck yeah.
Oh, man. I will never forget meeting Terry O'Quinn at Comic-Con, and I was dressed as Rorschach at the time. So this is just a story about how cool I am. But he was walking by and I just shout. I didn't know what to do. So I just shouted out, I love the stepfather. And he turned around. He looked right at me or probably at the person next to me because he was like, that guy's in a mask. I don't know who said what. But he said, wow, that's an old one. And just turned around and got into his car and left. I feel like, I mean, everybody has that story, right?
Well, our friend who's been on the show, Wendy, has her story of she's going down an escalator and Bruce Greenwood is coming up the escalator and she just freaks out and she just goes, she points and he kind of is very, like, very casual about it, but like, yeah, it's me. And she goes, oh my God, I love you in the core. And his face just falls into this look of confusion and he just turns around on the escalator as they pass. Like, he's just like baffled. He's like, the core.
All right. It's time to go to the sidebar one more time. Eric, you live in New York City. You have
New
to have,
York City.
New York City. You have to have a story or two about this, right?
About what?
About meeting an idol that you have, but maybe somebody you idolize for something that not necessarily everybody else idolizes them for.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. There's a few random things. Speaking of 90s sitcoms. I once worked a summer with Tim Daly and I was driving him around in my car for an entire summer.
Really?
Yeah, I was a production assistant on a horrendous movie that is now titled The Good Students. And interesting driving him around. But also, like, I was once an intern on Conan O'Brien when he taped in New York. And Rob Lowe, I always thought Rob Lowe would be pretty cool.
Not so much.
Not the stories I've heard.
There was a thing where it was just like, we had to like, okay, so Rob Lowe shows up with like this entourage and, we have to get him, like 20 pizzas by the time he gets off stage. And you got to go to all these different pizzerias and coordinate it because a single pizzeria can't make that many pies in the amount of time given.
What?
I never told this story before publicly, so I don't.
A JFC exclusive, everybody.
Well, listen, if Rob Lowe's listening, This is just an amusing anecdote.
I don't know. Not anybody listens to this show very much.
Oddly enough, I think I know we're recording this. It's not actually live, but I just got a text literally as you finished your story about Wendy Cargill from our buddy Adam Charles. And apropos of nothing, unless he's literally listening into this room, he just texted me, "Were the effects in the core ever good?" It was the I was looking at like Adam, are you is like seriously are we wired? Is that what's happening right now? Do you have microphones in your house?
The answer is the effects in the core are still good.
there is an informant within Junk Food Cinema.
That is the it is the biggest scandal of all time.
Sad. Actually, sad is a good way to describe this podcast sometimes. Hey, speaking of sad, I know a fact about this movie that is going to make Cargill very sad.
Oh, no.
Did you know that this movie had a rejected James Horner score? James Horner did a score for this movie. James Horner, who is a hero around the annals of junk food cinema. And I have to make sure I pronounce that with the correct number of N's or it's very filthy. The annals of junk food cinema, a hero. And his score was apparently rejected because, I shit you not, it was too ethnic and Irish tone. What does that even mean? That may be the most racist thing. Forget Chavez and China Girl. That may be the most racist thing about this movie.
You know, that would make sense considering what he was doing at the time. Because remember, he was like, at this point, this is post Aliens, and this is when he started doing a lot of his big stuff. And he had just done in this era An American Tale. Like, he was doing his big immigrant score and songs. And so it's very easy that he could have been inspired by Irish music and the ethnicities of what was, you know, that are afoot in this town, in this county, that maybe he had gone too far into that. And they were just like, yeah, we don't know about that.
Yeah, I think it was rejected because it's not your mama's Western. We can't have that old world music. This is a new world.
James Horner
down in a blaze of glory.
Damn it, Target. Wait till Young Guns 2 to start singing that. I've told you.
No.
Damn it.
Two movies are the same fucking movie. All right.
What's your position on Young Guns 2? Because mine is kind of sour.
I think it's also a movie. I stand firm on my belief that Young Guns 2 is the follow up to Young Guns.
It definitely exists.
It is a movie that exists that has one great moment. It's got one great line. The moment where he shoots the guy out of the window, he's like, best $1.10 I ever spent.
Yes. No, that is a
that
great moment.
That moment is that's such a great moment.
Cashed within about 85 bad moments.
Yes.
Emilio Estevez in the old man makeup and like Bradley Whitford, like, I want to know your story, old timer.
It's not good by any stretch of the imagination. Counter to this, which I think I legitimately dig this movie. In fact, I promised before the show that I would talk about the weird
that you would stop hitting me.
Stop hitting you.
God damn it.
No, there was a point in my life where I watched this movie every other day. It wasn't by choice.
I'm sorry.
Does that mean?
Like, wait, were you on the Manson Ranch and this was part of your programming?
It's literally, I don't know if I've talked about this on
you
this
definitely have
at
not
all.
Talked about
no,
this.
No. But there was a point in time where
you were
months,
in a Young Guns themed cult.
You would think so, actually. It seems that way because I was living with this crazy ex-Navy SEAL. And
speaking of 90s sitcoms, folks,
dude, well, I lived with him for 2 months and then he kicked me out because I wasn't cleaning every single beard trimming off of the sink. He found a few stray beard trimmings and was very upset about it.
And then you sat on the porch going, don't you do it. I got no place else to go.
No. So I ended up crashing on the couch of some friends and several of them were out of work and I had a job. So I kicked in for rent 1 month. And then, so I had a couch to sleep on for a while and it slowly turned into the apartment that I then lived in for a year and a half. But I had kind of taken over the rent. And so I became one of the actual owners of the apartment renters, but there were 8 guys living in a 2-bedroom apartment in Austin in the early aughts. And it was it was crazy. And we had a TV and a VCR and a PlayStation.
And a lot of bathtubs to make soap in.
And 7 VHS tapes. And one of those VHS tapes was Young Guns. And so the guys who were in the place, I was even Old Man Cargill at the time. I was 24 years old, and these guys were from, there it is, were 17, were 17 to 21 years old. So I was the older guy. So for them, this was this movie that came out when they were kids, whereas I was like, fucking Young Guns. But they would watch Young Guns every other day. And there was literally, like, it was the 18th or 19th time that Young Guns had been played over the course of a month that I literally just walked up to the TV, stopped it, pulled it out, and said, fuck you guys, we're going to watch something different. And they're like, what are you going to show us? And I'm like, Casablanca. And they're like, fuck you and your black and white movies. And of course, by the end, we ended up watching Casablanca every other day for the next.
So it was Young Guns one day, Casablanca the next day, then Young Guns again.
That was kind of my life for a while.
That's like a bizarre human centipede that I can't even wrap my head around. That is fucking crazy.
But yeah, but so I literally.
How dare you wait till episode like 205 of this podcast to tell that story like it's no big deal. And you just threw it away like, oh yeah, I used to live with an ex-Navy SEAL, and he kicked me out because I didn't clean his beard trimmings, and then I lived in what sounds like a Young Guns cult, the Deregulators, and we had a flop house on Paper Street where we made soap and watched all these VHS, and you just say that now like it's no big deal.
Because those are the least interesting parts of that time of my life.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's a humble brag if I ever heard one.
You know,
that's the least.
When I first moved to New York, I lived in a living room it was a one bedroom apartment, and there was another guy that lived in the bedroom, and I watched 24. I was like, I'm going to check out this show everyone's talking about.
Did you watch it for 24 hours?
No.
Just to make sure it lined up correctly.
I was working nights then. I used to work 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. So I'd watch it at like 8 in the morning until like noon and then go to sleep.
Wow. Is that why Kiefer Sutherland ranks so high on your hunkometer?
Maybe, yeah. And you know, we mentioned Stand By Me earlier. He was also in that.
He was.
He was hunking around for years.
Oh, dude. Well, we covered so many of his fucking great films from that era. I mean, we if we keep talking about Kiefer Sutherland and not mention Lost Boys, we're gonna.
Oh
get
no,
letters.
We did. We definitely did because he's playing a very similar role in this movie. He's part of a band of lost boys
who
get taken under the wing of not bats and vampires, but in fact Terrence Stamp, which is a little scarier if you've ever actually seen the original Superman movies, but I will leave that completely alone. But
even scarier if you've seen Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
This is very true. But now I'm just picturing like Bobby Brown doing a song about Kiefer Sutherland called Ain't Nobody Hunkin' Around, and I've got a new karaoke jam, so if we take nothing else away from this episode, which a lot of you might not. But the James Horner thing, to bring it back to that for a second, really pisses me off. Because if there is one thing, we've mentioned it already, if there's one thing this movie is, it's like a hunky Magnificent Seven. It very much feels like a Magnificent Seven, which James Horner is the king of doing scores for movies that rip off the Magnificent Seven.
Well, they do.
Yeah, but this Magnificent Seven, man, it fucks. That's the difference.
It really fucks. But not only does it fuck, it does a really great job of convincing us that these guys aren't the bad guys.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, I was wondering when we were going to get to this.
You know, eventually they go on that kill spree and they kill the sheriff who, you know, was sending guys their way or whatever. And then they just become this like outlaw anti-government militia. And Billy's just obsessed with getting the president's like eye to turn to this corner of the world. It is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, they really have it in this movie for Rutherford B. Hayes. Like you don't hear enough Rutherford B. Hayes slamming. You know what? In fact, I'm excited to see Jude Law next year in sexy Rutherford Hayes. Like that's definitely going to be an amazing
really
show.
All about fucking history today.
Yeah. Well, Horny History is a show we are going to get off the ground. Don't you worry about it.
Many people have tried. Few have succeeded.
Rutherford be laid, right? No?
See, it writes itself. It's right there.
You say that, but I feel like after my first pass, we should definitely get a writer. So, that James Horner thing really bothered me. But also the fact that you're right. At one point in this movie, you're like, are we still rooting for the – are we still rooting for the regulators? Or are they just like – yeah, I think anti-government
is
really the best way to...
They get downright vicious. Like, their version of revenge is really kind of... But I feel that's indicative of this era of the 80s that we slowly got out of. But this is still that whole... This is one of the problems that you and I have talked about with the various Charles Bronson movies of the 80s. It started off as being anti-violence and just became anti-minority.
Yeah, yeah. I think Eric could definitely speak to. I mean, you guys did an episode fairly recently on a movie we did an episode on from a completely different perspective, Death Wish 3, or as we called it, Death Wish 3 Urban Renewal, where he literally is just gentrifying an entire, like, rundown area of New York by leveling it.
Yes, and killing everyone involved. It's something else. You guys liked it a lot?
It's a hell of a thing. Give us a quick rundown, Eric. What are your feelings about Death Wish 3?
Well, I mean, like you guys are saying, like to a degree of it, it's just like, hey, Pally, you ain't white enough for this neighborhood, you know?
Oh, wait, can we get that again in your half-ass Charles Bronson?
No, he's talking to me because I also do a half-ass Charles Bronson impression that actually, it's not, Eric is pretty spot on with what my impression sounds like, which is, hey, it's the giggler, but by that I mean we changed a couple letters around from the word I used to call him, and it's like, Charles, let's just get you to shut up for a second.
And I'm not the best with impressions. The other guys on We Ate Movies are a little bit better at that.
It's always fun to hear, and it's something that I
think me and Eric need to have an impression off to see who can do the worst possible impression. Because mine are hot garbage.
Yeah, mine are so bad that they become endearing again. It like goes around the moon and it comes back a little bit.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, they really are just killing everybody out here, these regulators. It's like, and there's a point in the movie where like, okay, well, your deputization has been revoked. So now you're wanted by the legitimate law, those people outside the law. And at the end of the movie, they get all 5 stars at Grand Theft Auto because the fucking military shows up.
Oh, yeah.
It's true. By the way, we didn't mention Buckshot Roberts takes out Charles Sheen around now.
He does. Buckshot Roberts, which I was surprised was not played. I was not surprised. I was disappointed was not played by George Buck Flowers, because I feel like there's just a natural, like,
I think if
Kismet
your name is Buckshot
that.
Roberts, your name should probably be Buckshot Bob.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Really
Buckshot Bob. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good – why wasn't he Buckshot Bob? He needs a better PR person, I think, if he's going to be like the greatest bounty hunter of the Old West, who during the shootout manages to kill Charlie Sheen from inside an outhouse.
Yeah, he hides in the outhouse and then gets shot to shit in the outhouse.
I love that we're just gonna let that sit, and Eric's like polite giggle is gonna be the
that was legitimate, man. I thought that was good.
I didn't even, you know what, it was so good that I missed it the first second after you said it until Eric giggled. So I appreciate Eric reminding me when you're making jokes. But yeah, that's actually a really great scene, because he just shows up and he's like, all right, well, let's get this started. And your immediate thought is, they're all out in the open. There are 6 of them, and then Buckshot Bob, which is now how I'm going to refer to him. There's no way Buckshot Bob is making it out of this. And he ends up killing Charlie Sheen and wounding 2 of the other guys before he gets taken out. How are they that bad at killing one person?
Because they literally aren't killers. Like, that was what was so interesting about Billy the Kid, is he was the one guy who didn't have any qualms about shooting somebody.
Yes.
But all the other guys were not trained killers. And that is actually part of their backstory. I mean, that's the thing, is most of these guys that were involved in these various wars weren't actually hardcore murderers. And they just became murderers.
That's sort of exemplified in the film when they have this character McCluskey, who has been revealed, I guess, through William Bonney's own neurosis to be a spy for Murphy. He used to ride for Murphy. So Emilio Estevez just shoots this dude right in the head in front of everyone, and everyone's shocked by this.
Right in the face. Just like, I'm sorry I didn't snoop you out sooner, you traitor. Bam! Gone. And it's just, everyone else is just like,
Kiefer Sutherland is wearing his brain.
Yeah.
And they're like, what the fuck, man? Like, you can't just kill people in our gang. And all the while, the other 2 prisoners are like, Should we just go, or
it's a great kill too. Like, you see the splatter. I read on the IMDb Tribune that they used hamburger meat for his brains. And I feel like if you blow my brains out, it'd be hamburger as well, because it's always on my mind.
I feel like it would be chorizo for us. It would just be giant chunks of tacos.
I'm jealous of you guys, man. Chorizo is a soft spot for me.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
What is your favorite chorizo dish, if I could derail this podcast even further?
Honestly, anything. Tacos with eggs, whatever. Put it on anything and I will eat it. It'll create a soft spot around me.
Chorizo is best when served in a small pile in a queso.
Yes. Yeah. That's good too.
Also, I make a really, really super badass potato and chorizo quiche.
Yeah, so just come on over, Eric, and we'll pick you up some. It's a short drive.
Let me book my flight right now.
So what is the breakfast taco situation in New York? Is that something that's readily available?
No. You know, we have the bacon, egg, and cheese is sort of the go-to breakfast variety, and that's just, you know, cheese, egg, and bacon on a hard roll, and it is good if you get it at the right spot. But we don't have the type of Mexican food that you guys have available down there. Not by a long shot.
Having stayed there for a couple months while I shot a movie, I know that it's one of those trade offs where you guys do not have decent Mexican food there.
Right.
You do not have good Tex-Mex. You do not have breakfast tacos. Your bagels are off the hook.
Yep.
And ours are off the shelf.
This is true.
We also have pizza, which is now, I'm not saying about Texas, but most places don't have pizza.
No. Your pizza's pretty good. I was disappointed by how early the pizza places close in New York. I was told it was the city that never sleeps, but sometimes takes weed naps.
You are right on that, man. It is fucking bullshit. I working the night shift, it's like I couldn't go anywhere. Like, this city fucking sleeps like a dog.
Yeah, they like to claim that, hey, we're up all night. There's always something to do. And it's like, no, there's not.
No, yeah.
The city fucking closes down as early as every other fucking major city in the United States.
The only thing that's...
I can't get pizza at 1 o'clock.
You could go drinking until 4 a.m, and that's...
That's nice.
That's what you can do, and that's about it. You know, maybe you could find something that opens for food around that time, like, you know, like... hand foods or whatever, you know, there's stuff open, but it's hard to find. Bars are usually open, which is good. That's how We Hate Movies started, is drinking till 4 a.m.
That's actually how junk food cinema started. It was usually me over here at Cargill's drinking till 4 a.m, screaming about movies like 1990 Bronx Warriors and Battle Truck. So yeah, which, by the way, if you guys haven't covered Battle Truck, I feel should be on the shortlist as well.
Yeah, Battle Truck is something that sounds right up your alley. It's exactly.
Let me write this down. You guys are giving me so many ideas.
Which I'm sure is exactly what you were hoping for when I invited you to be on. They're like, hopefully what they'll do is they'll just tell us how to do our show for an hour.
Yes, please. Just can you take this off me?
I really want to listen to you guys talk about Molly, because that is one of those movies that once you have discovered will never leave your brain, and somebody needs to do it justice in totally dismantling it, and we're not those guys.
No, and I feel, though, if there is one person who has probably done Molly, it's Steven Sadak. So, you know, Molly on Molly would also be a really interesting movie experiment. So, again, not to tell you your business, but...
All right, just making another note real quick. On drugs. Okay, yeah. All right. So Young Guns?
Stargrove.
No. Stargrove. There we go. So bringing it back to Billy the Kid for a second, we talked about how this is kind of ridiculously one of the most accurate movies about the Lincoln County War. One of the things they mentioned specifically in the movie is that William Bonney is just another alias. Because so many movies and so many things that are written about Billy the Kid presume that his real name was William Bonney. But apparently that was just another alias, and they list his real name as Henry McCarty, which is historically now what people believe Billy the Kid's real name actually was. So it is, again, crazy how historically accurate, right down to the point that when we get to that finale where we're all holed up at Terry O'Quinn's house and the siege is coming, and... you'll notice that the battalion that they send is all African-American troops, which seems crazy when you think about the fact that this is the late 1800s. But apparently, getting real deep into when Colonel Nathan Dudley arrives, the U.S. Army was segregated at this time, and New Mexico was policed by the 9th U.S. Cavalry, a unit composed of African-American soldiers.
Yeah.
That is a detail nobody would have called them on if they hadn't, like, if they hadn't gone for it. But I love the fact that they're like, no, we're going to get this shit right. And then the next movie is going to be all about the Bon Jovi song. But this movie is about historical accuracy. That is nuts to me.
Except for Terrence Stamp, who is apparently 24 in real life, this character.
That is odd, actually, that they go so far into the details of the cavalry that showed up and the siege at the end of the story, but they also make Terrence Stamp, whose character, Tunstall, was 24, 25 in the real Lincoln County War, old man Terrence Stamp.
Well, because you need to have, like, that older guy to teach them how to read and this and that. If you just have, like, a rich guy doing it, yeah. They need that father figure. That's why they're all together, you know?
No, it's true.
It's what makes you, as the audience member, angry when he's gunned down.
That's true.
That you, right. Like, why would you want to see Jack Palance dead? Well, because he killed the father figure. That's, otherwise, how else are you going to not just love Jack Palance?
Yeah, I mean, unless he's going up against Tango or Cash. True story. But you know what? I understand your point, Cargill, because it's always important to have an older person around to teach the younger generation how to do things.
There it is.
Yeah,
are you going to press the button or not?
I might just press the button. The thing that's the craziest, though, is I watched the final siege where, like, half of the regulators get cut down and half of them get away from a house that is surrounded by soldiers, Gatling guns, all the rifles imaginable, and somehow half of them still get away. And sure as shit, that's what actually happened in the real story. I mean, he didn't come flying out of a second-story window in a trunk and somehow didn't break every bone in his body, as it happens in the movie.
Well, I mean, he didn't have a refrigerator to do it with.
That's true. You know, if they had refrigeration in the Old West, he definitely would have escaped.
And he could have survived a nuclear blast.
That is what I've heard about refrigerators in the Old West.
Well, the refrigerator in the Old West was a giant cube of ice, right?
So he just comes, okay, better scene, guys. He comes riding down the top of the roof on a giant block of ice, still firing guns. That's like,
yeah,
that's like Slim Pickens on top of that bomb in Dr. Strangelove. Like, that is a movie-making scene. That definitely would make the trailer.
Ice to meet you. Cool party.
I hate it when they talk during the movie.
This movie is missing puns, I feel. It could have used a few more puns.
No,
yes. I'm going to stand by that, Cargill. I think it could have used more puns.
Dumb it up, man. Dumb it up.
The thing about this movie is that it's legit. Like, it is a legit movie. This movie, despite being at this point in the 80s, actually takes itself seriously and doesn't ever try to be ironic. It could be. It's trying to make a Western for the youth of the 80s, but instead of being ironic, they are just completely sincere, and the movie works as a result.
It absolutely does. And
that's true. I will say the end fights, the end shootout sequence in that house, I feel like drags a little bit. It goes on a little too long for my taste, but
I would agree with that. One thing that's interesting about that final shootout is apparently, as you would maybe guess with this cast, there was a lot of drinking and partying on set.
What?
I know.
The Brat Pack?
I don't mean
the devil, you say.
Tell apocryphal stories, but it was probably more like an apocalyptic moment.
The Ringwald, you say.
Drinking it like the world was going to end. But apparently the only sane, by multiple different interviews with multiple cast members, the only sane one on set was Charlie Sheen, who routinely had to wrangle the others to stop drinking and partying so they could... Are you fucking kidding me?
That is how Tiger Blood works. See, the thing is what you have to understand is Charlie Sheen is actually the great balance of the universe. And so whenever he's around drinking and drug using, he is the most sober person. And when he's surrounded by sober people, he has to take all that upon himself to bring balance to the universe.
I feel like you are going to write that into the next Doctor Strange movie, aren't you? Like, that Charlie Sheen is somehow the focal point of keeping balance in the universe.
No.
Okay.
Charlie Sheen, I've come to negotiate.
Wild Thing, I've come to drink. I would watch that movie. I'm just saying. Yeah.
No, it's Charlie Sheen, I've come to Wild Thing.
That's true. That's much. See, that's why you're writing Doctor Strange, too. And I'm just,
you make my heart sing.
And I'm just pitching it to you. This
make
is
everything.
I'm a doctor and a wizard, but I can't get all these STDs out of you.
There's only so much one can do.
He's trying to use the time stone to make the chlamydia go away.
If we go back before you banged everyone.
That is just wretched. Yeah, well, another thing I found interesting, I just found this out about Terrence Stamp. Apparently, he roomed very early in both their careers with Michael Caine, but they hadn't spoken in 40 years since then. What happened? You want to talk about TV shows I would watch? Yeah. Young Terrence Stamp and young Michael Caine.
It's because Michael Caine kept on putting Young Guns on VHS on.
He didn't clean up.
It is something like what happened with David Carradine, where
he took a lot of peyote.
No. Because I very early in my career, I actually got to sit down with David Carradine, and I said, "Man, you worked with Steve McQueen. What was that like?" And he just looked at me and he goes, "Well, me and Steve didn't get along too well. So we talk. We just one another."
What?
Honest to God, this is the answer David Carradine. And the way he said, "We just stared at one another." So David Carradine and Steve McQueen didn't like each other and gave each other those vicious stares that we've been watching on screen for years. They got them for free just because they didn't like each other. See, and I feel like that might have been what happened with Terrence Stamp and Michael Caine, where they just got barred with Sean Connery.
What? Now? Okay, say that again. I know,
you were too busy doing your Michael Caine impression. No, there were Michael Caine and Michael Caine, Terrence
Who's
Stamp.
Who's cocaine?
Michael Caine, Terrence Stamp, and Sean Connery all used to run around together during those years. What? And they used to throw these parties called a bottle and a bird party, where you either came to the party with a bottle of alcohol or you came to the party with a girl.
Or you came to the party with a VHS copy of Young Guns.
Of Young Guns. And so what he would end up doing is they would all, you know, kind of hang out. And one night, some guy in a bar was disrespecting this girl, and Sean Connery told him to stop. And the guy told Sean Connery to go fuck himself.
Uh-oh.
And Sean Connery takes off his jacket and hands it to Michael Caine. And Michael Caine just holds his jacket while Sean Connery proceeds to beat the fuck out of not one, but two guys. And then Sean Connery gets done beating the fuck out of these guys. And Michael Caine hands him his coat back.
Wow.
Because that was the kind of friends they were. Michael Caine's the guy who will hold your coat while you beat the shit out of somebody.
Hold my beer. I feel like to bring this full circle, he actually beat up 2.5 men in that bar, and we're back to Charlie Sheen.
That's the kind of friend you want.
So what else about the plot do you think we need to cover? Because I feel like
that's the whole thing, is there's really not a plot here with outside of the standard revenge story. Like, we spend some time setting up why these guys are friends.
Yeah.
And then they fucking, you know, shit goes bad, and then they just kill everybody. And
you get to see Jack Palance get shot in the head.
Oh, he has a Yaphet Kotto death, which is something we talk about around Junk Food Cinema because it's right.
He also kind of has a Jack Palance and Tango and Cash death.
That's a very, yeah, which is just,
Tango?
And it's Cash. It's because his death in Tango and Cash is just a nod to the death of Mr. Han in Enter the Dragon, which is exactly the same type of death, where it's like, I get struck in the head, but it takes me a little while to realize that I am, in fact, dead.
Well, here's the interesting thing that needs to be, for historical perspective. Jack Palance had been a minor star and then had waned and then gone and done a bunch of Italian films, as Brian will tell you at length.
Yeah, it's true. I verified.
Just at the end of his career, he came back and became a big star in Hollywood again, and made all of these films. And this is part of the beginning of the Palance.
Yes.
Believe it or not.
That was how I grew up knowing him, was on Ripley's Believe It or Not, is he was a TV show host.
Yeah.
He was not a badass actor. He was a guy that go, believe it or not. And that was how I knew him. And so we used to joke about that through the first few movies that he did, until we were like, dude, this guy's too fucking cool. He's so much cooler than that TV show. And then you start going back and examining films and realizing, oh shit, he was in all this great Italian stuff, and he was in all these great Westerns and movies back in the day. But yeah, this is the Palance. And this is like what kicks it off, is he is...
Or a golden palance. Like, you move into a... with many rooms, my father's house. Never mind. Don't worry.
I took a golden palace once. And
how much did she charge you for that?
What's over it? In Russia.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Wasn't that a Golden Girls spinoff?
Thank you for continuing to be a friend, even when the grosses are down again. Yeah, no, I definitely would watch any and all of those shows. But yeah, you're right. He Neesoned. Jack Palance totally Neeson.
Yeah, he just kind of came out, and we got several great years of him being villains or being, you know, curly. And it was
crap bigger than you.
It was a wonderful time.
Which,
but yeah, he gets a great death here.
So good. Like, he's shot from the other side of the street by Emilio Estevez and literally has the, like, I've been shot in the head. I have thoughts on this. And he just keeps, like, it's like, dude, you should have been down the second that bullet went in. But he looks like he's about to deliver a monologue.
I'm sorry, are you a doctor?
Are you? You know what? I will get my degree from St. Michael's in July and begin practicing medicine here in Lincoln County.
You're going to be okay.
Say the goddamn words. You're going to be okay.
Oh, my God. Jack Palance is every Reservoir Dog is the movie that we need to somehow make happen.
How many dicks is that? It's the world's tiniest violin playing for the waitresses.
I'm a fucking professional. Digging tunnels.
I love that we all just assume he's Steve Buscemi. Like, we said all, but really we just meant Steve Buscemi. Like, I also just wanted to be like, Larry, stop pointing that gun at my dad.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy, or are you going to bite?
It works! Every piece of dialogue in that movie sounds like it should be coming out of Jack Palance's mouth. How did I never notice this until now? That's fucking incredible.
Wait, no.
Unstargirl?
Why am I Mr. Brown? That sounds like Mr. Shit.
What? Why am I Mr. Pink? Because you... No, I can't say that.
Some other guy had some other job as Mr. Black. You're Mr. Pink. Now you can Stargirl.
I'm sorry. I forgot. Oh my gosh. And this brings us to the part of the show that is, in fact, the reason we do this show, the junk food pairing, which I'm going to go with my junk food pairing for this movie is actually a bowl of cream of mushroom soup, but it is in an old fashioned clay bowl so that it can look like peyote, which is apparently what they actually used for peyote in this movie, was a bowl of cream of mushroom soup. So yeah, enjoy that if you can't get a hold of actual peyote.
I'm kind of the opinion that this is kind of a Franks and Beans movie.
Okay.
Like, if you're going to, like, sit down and eat something with Young Guns, Franks and Beans is kind of the way to go.
Now, are we looking at the Franks or the Beans? Jack Palance in every movie. Hashtag Jack Palance in every movie.
I got one for this, too.
Yay!
I
think,
Dan, I'm going to say Doritos because it's vaguely Western corn chip. And then you dust it with the, you know, the flavoring that white guys love.
I love that. I think that's
Are you calling this the neckbeard movie to end all neckbeard movies?
No, I'm not. I'm saying I like Doritos.
Gonna wash that down in a little Mountain Dew there?
All the Mountain Dew. Code Red, of course. Code Red or nothing. And I feel like the one junk food pairing that all of us missed that we probably should have thrown in there is a big jar of Pace. Because the Texas podcast that is bringing on somebody from New York City.
What you do is you dip the Doritos in the salsa.
I mean, we could also go with hamburger.
Yeah.
Have a kefir burger. You make a hamburger, you wear it all over your face.
How are those maggots in your burger, Michael? How are those maggots? Oh, my gosh. Eric, I have to thank you so much for joining us for this episode on Young Guns. And I hope you've had as much fun as you are probably thoroughly confused right now.
I've had a blast. Thanks for having me. You guys run a great show. And just want to tell your listeners that they could check out We Hate Movies at whmpodcast.com. And I don't know if you know this, but I have a podcast exclusively on the subject of TJ Hooker.
Yes, you do.
It's called Hooked on TJ Hooker, and you can find it at tjhookerpodcast.com. No one listens to it.
I have listened to it. I thoroughly enjoy it, and I am a big fan of We Hate Movies. So this was, like, I said this last week, and I'll say it again because I think it's even more valid. Marvel can kindly suck it. This is the most ambitious crossover of all time, and I'm so happy that a podcast that I have known and loved for so long, We Hate Movies, we have you, Eric, on the show, and I just I have to say thank you again for joining us.
Well, thanks for the kind words. And seriously, like, you guys do a great job. I've listened to several episodes and really had a great time listening to them.
Thank you very much,
sir.
Thanks
so much.
And if you'd like to hear more of the episodes that are now WHM approved, you heard it here first, no takesies, backsies. We are on Blog Talk Radio as well as iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. And this is June 12th. My new book, We Are Where the Nightmares Go, comes out in hardback and in audio editions wherever you buy your books. So it's time, folks. I got to play that card where I got to pitch something. So please pick up We Are Where the Nightmares Go. It's a collection of 10 horror stories that range from the comical to the absurd to the terrifying.
Yeah, it's really rare that you would pimp something. So I'm glad you finally got the chance to do that.
I'm sorry I put out a book or a movie once a year.
I thought you were just going to stop at I'm sorry I put out. And baby, I would never blame you for that.
Yeah. Don't slut shame me. Where can everybody find you on the internet?
Well, I just said the podcast right. Destination, but you can follow me on Twitter. Why not? At Eric Siska. And this is a doozy. This is a name you don't see out probably west. E-R-I-C-S-Z-Y-S-Z-K-A. Yes, S-Z repeats.
Oh, so you are the Young Guns member that everyone forgets.
Or that yeah. Dermot Mulroney is very racist toward.
I'm the Pollock that dies in the ditch before the Young Guns come together.
That's a word we don't use.
I'm gonna tell you the same thing that I tell all the players when I watch NHL games, Eric. Your last name needs to buy a vowel. But other than that, you're a great guy, and we very much appreciate you being here. And we're gonna go out by letting you know that it's all the same, only the names have changed, and dead or alive, we are definitely going to dip some Doritos into some paste because we don't buy our salsa from New York City!